Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Fed is trying everything it can to turn this thing around, guaranteeing practically every account in sight, lending money like it's going out of style, more just today, in fact. And the whole while, the rest of the economy is just trying to catch up. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Marketplace entrepreneurship reporting is supported by Lenovo, makers of ThinkPad and new IdeaPad notebook PCs, dedicating 1% of income supporting entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It's the 21st of October as the financial crisis winds its way through the economy. For what seems like the umpteenth time, the Federal Reserve took another big jump into the credit markets today. We will explain the latest miracle cure. And you remember the phrase, too big to fail, right? What do you suppose happens when banks that are getting federal bailout money want to go out and buy other banks? Yes, it's deja vu all over again. But first, the Fed. Mr. Bernanke and company announced today they're going to start buying commercial paper from money market funds. Just by way of refresher here, those money markets are a key source of liquidity. Gee, where have you heard that word before? In the short-term credit markets. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports.
Another day and only another $540 billion committed by the Federal Reserve. Finance professor Dan Seaver at San Diego State University says the goal is the same. The central bank is trying to melt more of the ice that's still gripping the credit markets.
You know, every day they have a new program. The idea is they keep throwing stuff on this to try and thaw it out. And I guess whatever it takes, whatever it does to their own balance sheet, they're willing to do it.
The Fed's new focus is on money market mutual funds, which get cash from investors and then lend it out. But recently, they've been hoarding it because customers have been demanding their money back. The Fed reports investors have pulled $500 trillion out of money market funds in just the past couple of months. In the rush to pay their investors back, funds had to sell investments at a loss. Seaver says they're in danger of losing so much, customers could get back less than a buck for every dollar they put in.
The Fed is trying to backstop that by saying, okay, you don't have to dump these on the open market. We'll take them and we'll give you cash for it, and then you can meet your redemptions and you don't have to worry about the potential for breaking the buck.
And perhaps more importantly, keep lending. The central bank's focus now seems to be moving beyond the big banks to other areas of the credit freeze, and Seaver hopes it signals the Fed is finally getting ahead of the curve. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
A number of regional banks reported earnings today. Not so good. KeyCorp, Fifth Third, and National City all showed losses. Some of those banks are expressing an interest in getting a share of the government's direct investment. The bailout is another way to say that. And so help turn their fortunes around and possibly buy other banks. From New York, Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports now on using taxpayer money to consolidate.
Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson said nothing about funding bank mergers and acquisitions when he laid out his plans for injecting billions of taxpayer dollars into banks.
Our purpose is to increase confidence in our banks and increase the confidence of banks so that they will deploy, not hoard, their capital.
He also said nothing about not funding bank mergers and acquisitions. Karen Petru is managing partner at Federal Financial Analytics. She says government-financed M&As would be a big mistake.
Mergers and acquisitions ought to be the province of institutions on their own. And if it's essential to rescue an institution, then we need to do that, I think, through the FDIC.
Petru says putting the nation's banking system in even fewer hands would likely mean fewer mid-sized regional banks, making it even more difficult for small businesses to get loans.
That's the risk, absolutely, with nobody in the middle. And we do need viable regional banks.
Cornelius Hurley directs the Morin Center for Banking and Financial Law at Boston University. He says the government should take a seat on bank boards if it wants to keep banks from using taxpayer money for M&As.
I'd like to have our representative there saying, hey, wait a minute, maybe we should be expanding the lending portfolio rather than just acquiring this next bank with the money that we have available from the government.
After all, he says, getting banks to start lending again was the point, wasn't it? In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
We'll break into our coverage of the financial crisis now for this update on the regularly scheduled economy. It's not just regional banks making less money. Caterpillar's earnings slid today thanks to higher raw material costs and the global slowdown. And the company wouldn't even tell us what it's expecting for next year, saying conditions are just too uncertain for all those usual predictions. Ashley Milne-Tite reports now on corporate profits in a slower economy.
Some companies reporting earnings aren't even saying how they expect next year to pan out, as they usually do, and that could leave investors jittery. Diane Swonk is chief economist at Mesirow Financial. She says this third quarter is yesterday's news, but investors want to know where a company's going in a wavering economy.
And to not have any certainty about that and not to be reassured about that, that'll only feed into this inability for us to sort of really gain some ground in the overall equity markets for a while and to feel like we're on firmer footing.
Swonk says there's a danger that a slew of disappointing earnings could see the market drop to a new low. Ben Halliburton is chief investment officer at Tradition Capital Management. He says today's earnings news wasn't all bad. 3M, maker of everything from Post-its to chemicals, reported an increase in profits as most of its divisions grew. And he thinks investors will distinguish between the winners and losers in coming weeks.
As opposed to this broad-based panic that we had over the past couple of months, where even companies that were actually doing pretty well got hammered pretty severely.
Still, Halliburton says this is a tough operating environment for most companies. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Speaking of tough operating environments, that pretty much was Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. When things are bad, it's always tempting to try to find the silver lining, some clue that things aren't as bad as they seem, or that at least they've been worse before. By most accounts, this is no Great Depression we're looking at, but commentator and novelist David Liss says while historical context offers perspective, rarely does it provide anything like comfort.
Irrational greed is nothing new. In fact, Wall Street emerged from America's first encounter with the sort of disastrous exuberance that has produced the current financial crisis. And like today, the markets of the 18th century had to learn the hard way the consequences of a system that offered no restraints. In the early 1790s, the first Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton, took innovative measures to strengthen the nation's new economy. His efforts were undermined by his former assistant, a speculator named William Dewar. Dewar decided to use his inside information to build a massive personal fortune. He borrowed from banks he wanted to seize. He borrowed from his partners after lying about his worth. He borrowed from citizens by promising an impossible rate of interest. Not surprisingly, he failed. His lenders thought Dewar was too big to fail, so his bankruptcy set off a panic that nearly destroyed Hamilton's fledgling banking system. The government swooped in and snapped up securities to stabilize the markets. The same speculators who earlier wanted government out of the way now realized they had to be saved from their own greed. In response, a group of stockbrokers gathered under a buttonwood tree on Wall Street to form the now famous Buttonwood Agreement. It established what was to become the New York Stock Exchange. These founders of Wall Street believed they could establish rules to prevent speculators from ever again risking the nation's economy. They took it as an article of faith that rational actors engaged in rational trade could, as a group, keep each other in check. They learned the wrong lesson. Investment strategies may be rational, but speculators engaged in wild trades with huge profits in the balance cannot be. They are like gamblers at the craps table, high on a good roll. A system cannot police itself when success makes its participants oblivious to the consequences. Looking over the wreckage of the past few weeks, you have to wonder when we're finally going to learn this lesson.
David Liss is the author of the historical novel The Whiskey Rebels. You can send us your perspectives. Go to our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Today was a day of reckoning in the credit default swaps market. Those are the contracts that companies make with each other to protect against losses in the bond markets. And specifically today, we're talking about the market in Lehman Brothers swaps. When Lehman went under a month ago, there were fears that it would take as much as $400 billion in swaps with it and leave everybody else holding the bag. But as our New York Bureau Chief Amy Scott reports, nobody knows yet exactly how big that bag's going to be.
After Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy just over a month ago, some analysts predicted a tsunami of losses from credit default swaps. Here's one analyst on CNBC a few weeks ago.
We really think that there could be multiple trillion dollars of notional exposure out there to these Lehman credit default swaps. We don't
remember, those swaps are kind of like insurance on Lehman Brothers bonds. When Lehman filed for bankruptcy, the sellers of that insurance had to pay up. Today is the deadline. Initial estimates put the price tag at close to $400 billion, but Bob Pickle says only about $6 billion will actually change hands. Pickle is head of the International Swaps and Derivatives Association. He says many of the dealers who sold insurance on Lehman bonds also bought insurance, essentially canceling out their exposure.
So, in fact, all this talk about these amounts of money that need to move on Tuesday, October 21, we think are very overstated.
Still, some institutions stand to lose a lot of money. Puneet Sharma is a credit strategist at Barclays Capital in London. His bank bought most of Lehman Brothers after the bankruptcy. Sharma says hedge funds have been badly bruised by the market downturn. He says if some now have to pay insurance on Lehman's bonds, they may have trouble coming up with the cash.
In the background of everything else which has happened over the last month, we've seen unprecedented moves in the market across asset classes. And I think this could just be the straw which breaks the camel's back.
It may be a while before we know the extent of the damage. The swaps market is largely unregulated, so it's hard to know who bought insurance and who sold it. Michael Greenberger is a former regulator with the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. He teaches law at the University of Maryland. Greenberger says that lack of certainty about who owes what to whom is what this credit crisis is all about. He says if the Lehman payout ends up in the hundreds of billions of dollars, it could further paralyze the markets.
Contrarily, if the amount owed is on the more optimistic side, that could unfreeze the credit markets because it will demonstrate that even in a cataclysmic failure like Lehman Brothers, that the system was set up in a way to protect itself.
The system will get another test this week. On Thursday, an auction will determine the value of bankrupt Washington Mutual's bonds and how much insurers will have to pay. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
And now, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials chucked yesterday's gains and dropped 2.5% today, 231 points to close at 9,033. The Nasdaq gave back 4.1%, 73 points, ended at 1,696. The S&P 500 offloaded 30 points, that's about 3%, finished the day at 955. A raft of disappointing earnings did the damage. Yahoo shares declined all day and closed down 12% on expectations that its quarterly earnings would disappoint when they were announced after the bell, and disappoint they did. Yahoo's profit fell 64% last quarter. The company's going to lay off 10% of its 14,000-strong workforce. Apple also reported after the close its profit beat expectations, but sales were less than hoped for. That doesn't bode well for the holiday season, gang. You are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about business at Gather.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com. Want more from Marketplace's special coverage on the fallout from America's financial crisis? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, staff blogs, and videos. Go to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. Martin Luther King III holds a meeting of civil rights leaders to talk about poverty and violence. President Bush meets with Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. And epidemiologists mark the 22nd anniversary of International Infection Protection Week. The best way to guard against germs? Just wash your hands. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Not that this ought to be taken as a comment on which way the economy may be headed, but we ran a story last week about people who are living below the federal poverty line and have been there for years. We pointed out that Washington first started calculating that line back in the 1960s, and minus some changes for inflation, the basic formula hasn't changed much since. Adam Shields from Marietta, Georgia, summed up the solution most of you offered.
Why is it that there should be a single poverty line anyway? There are clearly different costs of living around the country. There should be different poverty standards as well.
Tess Vigeland sat down with author B. Wilson to talk about food fraud while I was off yesterday. Wilson's book, Swindled, it's called, details the economic factors that lead to food fraud and the price we all have to pay for it. She suggests the best way to protect yourself is to reacquaint yourself with cooking and how different dishes ought to taste when they're prepared with the proper fresh ingredients. Chris Hyland from Walla Walla, Washington, thought Wilson didn't go far enough.
While I enjoyed the story, I think B. Wilson did not adequately answer the question of how one can protect yourself from these concerns. What one needs to do is, quote, know your farmer. Shorten up your food chain, buy from farmers markets, buy from small producers, and ask questions about your food and where it came from.
So that was, what, 35, maybe 40 seconds without a mention of the financial crisis? Well, you can stop that clock right now. In a general comment on the crisis and our coverage of it, Susie Stone wrote from Jacksonville, Florida, to say she's a little disappointed with her peers for not being the gatekeepers that they were taught to be.
I graduated from a top-tier business school in 1982 with my master's degree. I find it particularly appalling that the current economic crisis has happened during the period when more people have had graduate education in business than ever. I thought the whole purpose of MBAs was to train us not to make the same mistakes of the past.
And finally this week, an economic indicator that can be good or bad, depending on how you look at it. Crude oil closed down $4 today, almost 5%, at about $70 a barrel. A lot of our letters note that the declining price of oil may be a troubling sign of the economic times, but all the same, you want to see some love at the pumps. Joe Shields from Indian River, Michigan, wrote to say that Americans are doing all they can to keep those prices high. We did it to ourselves, he writes. Everyone trying to keep up with everyone on the block, living way above their means, driving the biggest toy, and look now where we are. No matter where you are, and no matter what you drive, we'd like to hear from you. Go to our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Just as most of the business press has moved from covering the mechanics of the bailout to the wider effects of the credit crisis on the economy, Congress has changed its focus as well to finding somebody to blame. After he wrapped up a hearing today, House Financial Services Committee Chairman Barney Frank said he really doesn't think anybody on Wall Street ought to be getting any bonuses anytime soon. Other hearings have focused on the companies in the headlines, Lehman Brothers and AIG, to name a few, and their excesses. Tomorrow, the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee takes on the credit rating agencies and the part they played in the mess we find ourselves in. Democrat Henry Waxman chairs that committee. Congressman, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Pleased to be with you.
I wanted to ask you, first of all, Congressman, about this hearing tomorrow on credit rating agencies. Where would you put them on the culpability scale for this economic mess we're in?
One of the key issues we're going to be looking at is why the credit rating agencies gave such high ratings to risky mortgage-backed securities. In some cases, AAA ratings that didn't deserve AAA ratings, and investors relied on those ratings to their detriment.
You presumably are going to have a major role in the regulation that everybody assumes will come to the financial industry either later this year or in the new Congress. Where are you in putting those new rules together?
What I think we need to do is to examine what went wrong, who should be held accountable, in order then to figure out what we need to do in order to start fixing this mess. And we've held last week two hearings and this week two hearings and then more to come. Our first hearing focused on Lehman Brothers, the largest bankruptcy in U.S. history. Our second day of hearings focused on American International Group, AIG, one of the world's largest insurance companies. Now, there are differences between Lehman and AIG, but in each case, the companies and their executives grew rich by taking on excessive risk. And what is most troubling was the CEO's refusal to accept any blame for what happened to their companies.
But we've got a pretty good idea, Congressman, of where the blame lies. It lies with Wall Street excesses. It lies with regulatory failures. It lies with some of these CEOs that you've had in front of your committee. When are we going to know what the new regulations are going to look like?
I think some of the major reforms we're going to have to enact will probably be put off until next year. The House Banking Committee, chaired by Barney Frank, has been holding hearings as well. They're the committee of jurisdiction for almost all of these reforms, and we hope to have some ideas to present to them when we're finished with our series of hearings.
What have you learned out of these hearings, besides the fact that CEOs made a lot of money and companies like AIG spent money foolishly, that is going to inform your recommendations to Barney Frank and the House Financial Services Committee?
I think we've learned that there are some areas that are not transparent. There are areas that are not being regulated. There are miscalculation of incentives that work to allow more risky investments than should be permitted with other people's money. And I think these are the kinds of things that we need to change.
What do you say to the banking industry when they come to you and say, Congressman, we don't need more regulation, we're just fine, and let us work this out by ourselves?
I don't believe them. That's what they've been saying for years. And we've had a whole process, especially under the Bush administration, of deregulation. It's been part of their ideology. And I think to a great extent, it has now led to the disaster that we're facing.
One last question for you, Congressman. Is regulation the answer to this economic mess?
I think regulation is never just an answer. I think smart regulation is essential, and making sure that we can keep the market incentives working for the shareholders and investors so that they're not walking into a situation that they think is secure, and then it all tumbles like a house of cards.
Henry Waxman, Democrat of California. He is the chairman of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. Congressman, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
The residential real estate forecast we all know about, generally lousy, continuing lousy for the foreseeable future, which has realtors doing anything they can to drum up sales. Our sustainability reporter Sarah Gardner usually tosses her junk mail faster than you can say recycle. But a glossy ad not too long ago from a local real estate agent caught her eye. The agent described herself as an eco-broker. So Sarah set out to discover exactly what that means.
Monique Caraba has her work cut out for her today. She's trying to sell an 1,800-square-foot, three-bedroom, two-bath home for $1 million. Make that $999,000, to be exact. She's getting mostly looky-loos.
Hey, thanks for coming by.
Caraba is a certified eco-broker. That's a professional designation she earned through a Colorado-based company called EcoBroker International. To earn that green distinction, Caraba paid $395 for 3 days of coursework and testing. She boned up on everything from asbestos to solar panels to so-called green mortgages. Caraba hopes it'll give her an edge. It already helped her get this listing, an eco-friendly renovation in Culver City, a small town surrounded by Los Angeles.
The water heater is a on-demand water heater. The roof is a 50-year recycled rubber roof made out of recycled tires. The
house's eco-minded investor is flipping the property after injecting over $300,000 into an ambitious remodel. In went energy-efficient air, heat, windows and appliances, insulated water pipes, CFL lighting, formaldehyde-free cabinets, and more.
I've had people at my listings go, green schmean, who cares how ecologically friendly this place is, to people that are embracing it and just can't get enough of it.
Former Department of Energy official John Beldock founded EcoBroker 6 years ago. He says 4,200 real estate agents have passed his program. Beldock describes them as pioneers who are changing the industry. Might be the National Association of Realtors will soon offer its own green certification as well. But don't expect PhDs in environmental science.
They know that they're really green ambassadors.
Beldock says that means an eco-broker may not know which solar panels a client should buy, but can refer the buyer to someone who does. And Beldock says don't expect an eco-broker to independently give a home a green rating.
We don't really want the real estate professional to feel like he or she has to give the house a scorecard.
Jim Niccolo is an architect and a blogger for Marketplace's Greenwash Brigade. He says the EcoBroker program is a step forward for environmentalism, but he'd sure like somebody to start defining what an eco-friendly home really is.
If you have a Hummer that has operable windows and bamboo paneling, is it green, or is it still a largely inefficient vehicle? And I think the same holds true for housing.
Niccolo suggests a green home should really mean an energy-efficient home. But the prospect of saving on utility bills in the future doesn't always convince homebuyers to pay extra now. Greg Sears and his wife checked out the Culver City house on a recent Sunday.
Because things are already so expensive. You know, we're first-time homebuyers, and it's $700,000, $800,000 to get a starter house, which is ridiculous.
EcoBroker's Beldock says the green premium has dropped dramatically in many markets. A good thing, too. It's tougher to get a loan on any house these days, green or otherwise. In Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $8 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note to wrap things up today, a lesson that no matter how rich you are, sometimes your investments just go south. And Kirk Kerkorian didn't get rich by riding a stock down. Kerkorian, as you might know, has been big into car companies for years. He's held big stakes in GM and Chrysler at various times. But he has apparently decided that the Ford Motor Company is not for him anymore. He started unloading some of his 140 or so million shares yesterday, said he'll get rid of the rest soon. With Ford closing at $2.31 today, it's a loss of about $600 million for Kerkorian since April. The real impact, though, is that the sale is going to be seen as a loss of confidence in Ford, which could hurt their ability to raise other capital at a time when, as we all know, capital and credit are the coin of the realm out there. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow fell 231 points, 2.5%. The Nasdaq lost 73 points. That's 4.1%. The S&P 500 dropped 30 points. That is 3% there. Thanks to Jennifer Collins, Renita Jablonski, and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up tomorrow on this program, we'll talk to Ed Liddy, the new CEO of AIG, about having U.S. taxpayers as a boss. And oh yeah, those credit default swaps again.
They are riskier products. We went far too large in them. It's really brought us to our knees. That business has been shut down. It will not be a part of us going forward.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Should be a pretty good conversation from the corner office. Please join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.